Once you had a glimpse, there's no way to go back. Raise yourself, it's big to go forever on the neck. Forever on the neck.
Hasta la pasta to all the mama and papa doinkas out there, and welcome to another episode of Big Zuko's Forever Almanac, a chronicle of reminiscences. I, of course, am your host, Daniel Kurland, as well as your Zook Master General, as we trek through this tome, trickle by trickle. An obsession is a tricky creature, isn't it? A lot of the time, we don't even realize that we're walking in its shadow, that its infection has already begun. And then next thing you know, you're in its jaws. Its claws are deep in you, and that shadow becomes a chalk outline because now there's nothing you can do. I saw some graffiti one day. That was it. It was a Wednesday. I was in Bushwick, and on the side of a building way up high was a stencil drawing of one of those coin blocks from the Mario games. Those yellow blocks with the question marks. I've always been more of a Sonic man myself, but I'll be the first to admit that graffiti of one of the rings from Sonic would have been a far inferior drawing. Those item capsules that contain the rings, though, that would actually be pretty cool and different, and alright, I am getting off track, and I could literally spend hours talking about Sonic the Hedgehog item capsules, and that's not what this is about. But there is this coin block in the upper corner of this brownstone, a wonder that I even saw it, the sun seething down like it was, as if trying to prove its existence. I wondered how many people even noticed it, with the bulk of the daywalkers plodding on with their heads down, avoiding contact and connection in coin blocks. But that was it. I saw some graffiti, thought it was cool, and moved on. Then I saw another one. It was only a few blocks further, but there was another identical coin block hidden on the side of a building. This was not earth-shattering. It caused a smile, a finger point, a stop of step, but still, just graffiti. I couldn't see that obsession's shadow was ebbing closer. It was maybe 15 minutes later when I saw the third coin block painted on the awning of a stone duplex outside of Bushwick when it got to me. This wasn't just a coincidence. These coin blocks were probably hidden all over Brooklyn. All over New York, even. For the rest of my walk, they were all I thought about. How many were there? How many had I already missed? Where would I put them if I was the artist? Who was the artist? By the end of the month, I had found 9 more coin blocks. 6 in Brooklyn and 3 in Manhattan. And I knew more were out there. I stopped using my Metro card, my body still going through its regular rhythms of buying the card every month, but I couldn't risk wasting time on the subway underground, missing blocks. When I realized that there could be coin blocks in the tunnels too, I nearly had a breakdown. That'd be the best spot for them even. When else do people's eyes have so much time to rove? I'll even admit that late one night, when the Bedford Nostrand station was closed for the weekend, I went in the tunnels. I went in the tunnels and searched and looked and scoured the dirty brick for graffiti. It was 3 a.m. and I had found none. There were other stations, though, other tunnels. I'd figure it out. I had already started putting together a rudimentary map of where the coin blocks were. There was, of course, no record of any of this on the internet, the masses of headhangers probably not even knowing they existed. No, very early on I figured out that this was all up to me. That cracking this code and finding them all was only something I could do. And it was upon this realization when I just found myself walking in the middle of the night, going under the flimsy pink tape tied around the stair banister, prohibiting entry to the subway, and having no idea how this happened. The last thing I remembered was ordering a medium pepperonzo from Rocco's Bakken Pizza, and now I was in a subway station, clueless. So I stopped. Or at least, I think I did. I needed to. I'd have gotten hurt, but I still think about them. And I didn't throw away my map. An obsession likely still has a fang or nail still wedged into me somewhere. But experiencing all of this stirred my memory of a certain entry out of the Forever Almanac where Big Zuko, too, was encloaked by obsession's cape, chasing his own coin blocks down. The coin blocks of the mind. This one's called Love is a 7-letter word spelled S-W-I- Z-Z-L-E. There was reason to celebrate. I had just successfully sold the short story in 12 parts to Dwell Magazine. The story is told from the perspective of a different piece of furniture in each part, as the events around A Spill of Bordeaux on the Love Seat are chronicled. Dwell, a home decor and furnishing publication, doesn't typically publish fiction. In fact, they never have. But my ever-useful agent, Lawrence Lawrence, not only swayed them on the matter, but are now also in talks with me to adapt the story for a younger audience for their soon-to-be-released Dwell Junior magazine. This was well-paying work, and if the story's garnered enough buzz, Lawrence thought it might become a good leverage tool in renewing interest in the Adventuestrian series, perhaps reintroducing the characters through a multi-part story in a magazine, which could then seg into a novel. He had mentioned that he was fairly confident that both Man and Beast Monthly and Portmanteau Quarterly would sign off on the plan. So as Lawrence and I celebrated, bottles were cracked and drinks were made. When I say bottles were cracked, I'm not speaking facetiously, but Lawrence was in the middle of experimenting with a theory he believed strongly in, that if you crack the side of a bottle of alcohol, then grab the sides and finish the job, like you would to crack an egg, that the alcohol becomes more potent and realized. Something to do with how the stuff spills out into the container below. I didn't understand it much, and I thought my alcohol was potent enough as it was, and if it wasn't, I'd just buy more potent stuff. But carrying on like this seemed to please Lawrence, and because of him, I was Mr. Dwell. And so, like I said, Lawrence and I celebrated, and bottles were cracked. While we were mixing our drinks, I noticed a container of swizzle sticks in my cabinet that were given to me at some gaudy affair that I never used before. These color translucent mottled pieces of plastic shaped like things to make you think you were drinking at a beach, and therefore more relaxed, and therefore living the perfect life. Sticks shaped like palm trees and flamingos and sailboats. I don't know why I grabbed them. Lawrence was yelling, music was playing, but I took them and I thought they might be fun. And at the least, I'd hear the clink, clink, clink of the ice cycloning around my tumbler glass. We sat down, and Lawrence arbitrarily grabbed two sticks, a neon orange palm tree and a neon blue mermaid, plopping the former into his drink and the latter into mine. Lawrence began a conversation with me, but I didn't hear a word. As soon as my eyes locked with the mermaid swizzle stick, I didn't hear a word. To describe what was so bewitching with the swizzle stick, one must first describe what was so lackluster about the other swizzle sticks. The other designs weren't nearly as detailed or interesting. Crude shapes would account for holes. The palm tree had no leaves distinguished, the flamingo had no demarcation line between his feathers and his legs, and the less said about the sailboat, the better. Perhaps most obviously, these sticks were not made with love, probably rushed products to meet a quota and satiate a demand. But the mermaid was an entirely different story. As I held the swizzle stick in my hand, turning it all over and inspecting it as Lawrence droned on, I saw the intense detail chiseled into the mermaid's face, the scales on her tail, the little coy half-smile filling up her face. Even attention was given to the small of her back, showing she was arching herself outward. These were all little touches that did not have to be there. They were not exclusive to how a mermaid must look, but they were there all the same. The curls in her hair, her eyelashes, deep, deep thought was put into this product, and none of the rest. Then, as soon as I thought I had discovered all of the mermaid's secrets, I noticed that due to the crook of her hand and how her body was positioned, the stick could also hang from the side of your drink when you were done with it. So you could look at it, all of it, rather than depriving yourself of missing any of it while you enjoyed your beverage. None of these other sticks had this second function. Most of these sticks barely fulfilled their primary function. As days evolved into weeks, which evolved into months, I found myself using the mermaid swizzle stick in all of my drinks, even ones that didn't need to be stirred. But there she'd be, hanging from the side or hovering around inside, the half of her that submerged, all distorted and stretched, but seeming to accentuate the stick's beautiful anomalies, magnifying them as I watched the news or complained over the weather. It wasn't long before I found myself in bars and the swizzle stick would be there. Bartenders would ask,
"Where'd that come from?"
But I wouldn't respond as I stared into the refracted plastic. As I walked down the street, my hands would comb over the stick in my pocket, counting the scales on her plastic tail. 37. Tracing the ridges on her outstretched arm, resting my thumb in that detailed small of her back, and as I'd walk through the city, I wouldn't hear the traffic sounds or see the walk signs flicker. I only felt the mermaid in my pocket. I was in that pocket too, and not on the street. This was all fine with me, honestly. I didn't see it as a problem. Simply me trying to insert beauty into my beverage time, and really, is that despicable? Is that not what the inventor of the decanter or novelty ice trays was attempting? Besides, it wasn't affecting my social life. In fact, I had a date for the evening and all was well. And did that not entitle me to enjoy a cold drink with my favorite finned female while I waited? I couldn't think of a better way to spend my time. The phone rang. It rang again. And finally knocked me out of my stupor. It was dark now. The ice on my drink long melted. The hands on the clock long shifted. The phone rang a third time, and I answered it, never breaking eye contact with the mermaid the entire time. It was my date for the evening. I had missed it. Shrill yells bled from my receiver as I kept staring at the see-through blue inches before me. I hung up the phone. I refilled my drink. I stirred my stick. I had been lost, staring at the swizzle mermaid for 9 hours. The phone rang again. This time, I didn't pick it up. Saturday morning, I poured myself a glass of orange juice, began discussing my Dwell Jr. alterations with my mermaid drink helper, and suddenly, it was Monday. The weekend evaporated. I looked out the window. My eyes hurt. My stomach hurt. I hadn't eaten anything for 2.5 days. Now it was time to do something. I felt like any great mystery or puzzle, one's natural fascination with it disintegrates once that puzzle is solved. So I thought that if I could track down the artist who designed the mermaid swizzle stick, I could ask them the inspiration behind it, study it, and put all of this behind me. I had to. I was not naive enough to think that tracking down this person would be an easy task. Finding the company that made a random set of swizzle sticks made in 1990 anywhere, let alone the person responsible for the design, would be likely as difficult as finding an actual mermaid. As I examined the sticks, though, it seemed that this journey would not be as difficult as I thought. The flamingos, palm trees, octopuses, and sailboats all had the logo Mama's Fish House stamped into their sides. A company that I could find absolutely nothing on and was surely long foreclosed when the swizzle stick industry didn't receive the boom that it expected. In the name of full disclosure, a Mama's Fish House did pop up in Florida, but upon further research proved to be a merchandise shop for the jam band Fish, owned by a barely literate man named Momo Mama. They have free shipping on orders of $10 or more. They also have that album where Fish is only playing traditional Hebrew music called Gefilte Fish, which is an extremely rare item, at least it is according to Momo Mama. Again, full disclosure. However, stamped on the mermaid sticks was something completely different. It simply said Zeus Swizz and the copyright sign, and then the word Dallas. This was proof that this certain swizzle stick was made by someone else, at least. Someone different who cared about what they were creating. And Dallas couldn't be a real hotbed for drink accessory companies. Had it said Los Angeles or New York or even Chicago, I'd have been concerned. But Dallas? I could do Dallas. And having the name of the company and their location would hopefully be enough. As I got up to begin searching for my answers, I could have sworn that the mermaid winked at me. It took me a week, which is an inflated amount of time, as I have to assume that every 2 hours I spent working was in fact 30 minutes of work, followed by being lost in the mermaid's intricacies for an hour and 30 minutes. Or more. But I came up with some answers. To begin with, Zeus Swizz was closed, as I figured it would be. They were a small independent company, and by following the trails of the owners online, it seemed like Margaret Winslow Peckinpah was the artist that worked there during the 1992 to 1994 window that Zeus Swizz was operating. Locating Margaret Winslow Peckinpah was a much more difficult task. The research I found seemed to indicate she was still in Dallas, but I couldn't find where. A regular person probably would have given up here. The makers of the palm trees and the flamingos and pretty much all of Mama's Fish House would have given up here. But not me. And thankfully, with the help of Jimmy Toretti, a local private investigator, $500 later, and my paycheck from my Dwell deal dwindling deeper down, I had a phone number for Miss Peckinpah. Now, I just had to get her here. My plan was mostly just, like a drink full of goodwill with ice cubes of deceit bobbing around the surface. And if you stir those ice cubes thoroughly enough, that deceit will melt and you'll just be left with a tall glass of altruism. I told her that I was a reporter doing a feature on the top 10 most niche industries in Dallas in the 1992 to 1994 time period, and that I'd love to interview her about Zeus Swizz. I told her she came in third, right above the company in Dallas that made the plastic covers that go on the end of shoelaces, and just under the company that makes pewter Pearl Jam belt buckles. My plan was simple enough. I'd have the mermaid swizzle stick out in my drink when she came over, and I'd gauge her reaction when she saw it, determining if she really was the one who made them. Myself, Mr. Toretti, and the $500 I gave him were all fairly certain that this Margaret Winslow Peckinpah was the same Margaret Winslow Peckinpah that worked at ZooSwiz. She had been incredibly brief on the phone, though, almost as if trying to avoid the subject. And while she did accept my invitation and plane ticket, and I sent her the details of the interview, something still felt off. It was entirely possible that this was just some senile old woman who was looking for a free trip to New York City and the opportunity to blather on to a pair of wide-open ears. So I was satisfied that my swizzle sting would cut through the treacle and get me to the truth. It was the day of the interview, and I was spending far too much time orchestrating my far too simple plan. Every few minutes, I was adjusting the placement of my drink on the table, looking for where it would be the most obvious, where the light hit it best, where it was devoid of shadow. 3 hours later, I determined that 15 inches away from the width of the table and 7 away from the length was the perfect placement for it. Then, an hour later, I conceded that 16 by 9 was in fact more perfect. And it wasn't until I was trying to determine if the mermaid swizzle stick should be inside the glass or hanging off the side, and which side to have it leaning on was a whole other issue entirely. War treaties were signed faster than this. Obsessive compulsive disorder was developed over less than this. That I heard a frail knock at my door that must have been Miss Peckinpah. I thought it was unusual that she was early, but she wasn't. It was when we had agreed to meet. I had just gotten lost in another swizzle circle. An event that was now so prevalent and expected in my life, I had given it a name. When I opened the door for Margaret Winslow Peckinpah, I couldn't stifle the beaming smile that spread across my face. She looked identical to the mermaid. The coy eyes, her hair, she even seemed to take my hand in the same way the mermaid swizzle stick clung to glassware. I felt like I didn't even need to continue with my experiment any further. This was obviously the artist, creating a monument of her youth and beauty, solidified in time in the form of barside accoutrement. We sat down together, me never breaking my gaze, afraid that doing so would shatter the whole illusion. I asked her pointless questions that provided answers I no longer cared about. She talked about plastic melting and color dye and pH levels and Dallas legislation in the mid-90s, and all I could think about was just buying a one-way ticket to Dallas and living with this real-life siren. If I could be this committed to a swizzle stick, think how committed I could be to an actual person. We kept flying through this interview that would never be printed, me jotting down fake notes, my ears hearing Margaret talk about bureaucracy, and my hands digesting it into sentence fragments like Margaret Winslow Zuko and Dallas equals mermaids equals everything. She never once mentioned the mermaid stick that adorned my drink, even as my fingers strummed upon it as we spoke about the past. The interview was coming to an end, and while I was entirely content just knowing deep inside that this was the mermaid, and perhaps, like actual mermaid, she just wanted a quiet life, being left alone, I was still left unresolved. So, as I thanked her for her time, and she approached the door to leave and said, "Goodbye," I blurted out, "Is this you?" as I clenched the swizzle stick in my hand and rammed it out at her. And then, Margaret Winslow Peckinpah burst into tears and fell to the ground. She wasn't the artist, I learned. She was the subject. She wasn't the artist. Her husband was, Donald Dangulus Peckinpah. The two of them happily lived together, living a modest life at ZooSwiz, where they didn't have lofty goals other than making an enjoyable product, which they did, and honoring one another, which they did. Margaret was Donald's muse and model. They had bounced around unsuccessfully from job to job, Donald never being able to play the corporate games that they required him to, his work passionless and dull as he often thought of his wife he missed at home. Until one day he finally decided to combine the two, make his wife the work and spread her beauty throughout the world. The world had seen enough palm trees, after all. This reality was, in fact, more inspiring and touching than if Margaret had been the artist after all. This was not something fueled by vanity or the fear of tomorrow, but rather the dedication and endless love that a husband and wife can feel for each other. I excitedly asked Margaret where Donald was, how I could get in contact with him, that I'd even be willing to go back to Dallas with her and save him the trouble of... It was at that point that Margaret burst into tears again, eventually gaining enough composure to choke out the words,
"Poor Donald's dead, honey. He took his own life years ago."
I sat down. I needed to. We both did. And my eyes trailed to the bobbing swizzle stick once more, except this time not because I was lost in it, but because I was trying to hide from what was going on in the rest of the room. The overwhelming sadness that continued to fill my Brooklyn home. The saddest thing was that Margaret told me that Donald's suicide was because no one ever appreciated or cared about his work. He didn't have illusions that he was creating something greater than he thought. He just wanted some sort of acknowledgement that people enjoyed what he was doing. that he should continue to do what he was doing, which I can only imagine becomes all the more difficult when what you're creating is a monument to your wife. But sales steadied, then declined, then stopped entirely. Flamingos were cheaper, sailboats were flashier, everyone loves an octopus, and Mama's Fish House had twice the facilities at half the price. I just wish I had gone through my cabinet sooner, tried to contact Margaret faster. Surely these differences wouldn't have kept Donald alive, but who knows? The one thing I was sure of, though, was that he had created something so beautiful and engrossing to me. It had devoured my days and taken residency in my life. I spent nearly $1,000 trying to find out who was the gifted artist behind these plastic drink stirrers, and the answer was a man, now dead, because he thought no one loved his art. I didn't love his art either. I was in love with his art. And if I could have told him that, maybe Miss Peckinpah wouldn't be returning to an empty bungalow in Dallas. Margaret left, and I wanted to stop her, but I was too drained to say or do anything. We maintained contact, Margaret and I. It seemed like she needed a friend, and I was happy to be there for her. But our conversations eventually became less and less frequent until we slowly drifted apart, like people are wont to do, and they finally stopped entirely. The second part of my 15-piece story in Dwell came out today. This story was from the Ottoman's perspective. I read through my piece in the publication, finally ending with the "For Margaret, my mermaid" dedication that she would never read. I poured myself a drink. I stirred it with my finger. Jesus, right? I mean, just, that's rough. And you see what can become of obsession, right? It can be a powerful force that steals your focus and rapes your time, but it can also lead to unexpected beauty. If not for the obsession that Bic Zuko had for that swizzle stick, he'd have never connected with Margaret Winslow Peckinpah and seen how strong love can be. Ultimately, he was too late, but perhaps his eyes are now open. I've certainly learned to curb my hunt for the coin blocks around the city. Not entirely, I'm sure, but in moderation. A healthy balance. And if we can all learn to tame our obsession into creatures that are less obsessy, we can only prosper. And if nothing else, I'd like to take this moment to communicate to the artist of those coin blocks. Whoever it is out there, I'm talking to you right now. Your work is loved. Your work has meaning. And your work has brought joy. Keep doing what you're doing. I'll keep looking for them. And hopefully, you haven't killed yourself. I've been Daniel Kurland with Big Zuko's Chronicle of Reminiscences. And until next time, the Chronicle is chroniclosed.
Once you had a glimpse, there's no way to go back. Brace yourself, it's Big Zuko forever on the neck. Forever on the neck.